I am very excited because this is a topic that I know Audrey and I met in August through the Climate Reality Project with Al Gore. And I know this is something that she is completely passionate about and that keeps her up at night and that drives her focus and energy during the day.
Well, you said keeps her up at night and keeps a lot of people up at night, doesn't it?
True.
I mean, and that's kind of the truth,
isn't it?
Through
worry and concern. And I think this is, I think that she brings a voice to this topic that is often ignored or just not even... Like, I don't think it's not even a matter of ignoring it, but just a matter of not even knowing that this is a problem. And I think that she's a great voice for that.
Some of us have intuited it in the past, have felt that we were losing something. I mean, I can tell you, for me, when I was a kid, for a long time, I thought I was going to be an astronomer. All right. And I was the kind of kid who I couldn't point out all of the constellations, but I could show you quite a few and impress you. Oh, that's Vega up there and Lyra, you know, and you know, oh, there's the Pleiades. And, you know, I could go boom, 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 boom. And, you know, it's a neat parlor trick. All right. And then I got to college and I took my first astronomy course and I realized how much math was involved, and that was kind of the end of that. I'm not horrible at math, but I don't have a passion for it. And I think sometimes you have to have. Although there are astronomers, Mark Hammergren, maybe you can tell me about this since you work at the Adler Planetarium. There are astronomers who don't follow the math route. They are the observers, there's a lot of amateur astronomers out there, and they look at the skies and they chart things and they discover things. It's still a world, even with satellites in space, where the average astronomer, if he works hard or she works hard enough, can find something, correct?
That's absolutely the case. And I think one of the best examples of this kind of work is not just the observational astronomers, the folks out there with their telescopes, but anybody on the internet connecting to the Adler and working with our Zooniverse programs, programs like Galaxy Zoo, Planet Zoo, Planet Hunters, and soon coming out Asteroid Zoo. This is where individuals can just log in and join into various astronomical research projects, just ordinary people.
And that is it's one of the few areas, I think, in science where people, the average person, can participate. What is that? Because the cosmos is so large that we can't possibly watch all of it at, you know, even the professionals?
That's part of the reason. There are so many subjects out there in the skies. But another part of that is that amateur astronomy has an incredibly rich history stretching back many centuries, of course, just like amateur science in general.
Mm-hmm.
So we have that incredible foundation that's been built up over centuries.
And, of course, the first amateur astronomer was Galileo.
yes,
I suppose.
Well, and professional, because he was getting paid for his work by his patrons.
But he got in a lot of trouble for that, too, you know.
Yes.
We wouldn't get in the same kind of trouble today. Because I was this kid who would go out, I would hear there's a meteor shower. I go out in the backyard, and this is in the suburbs of Detroit in you know, the late 50s, early 60s, and sit out there freezing my derriere in the cold and the dew, looking up at the sky to see how many shooting stars I could see, or watch a lunar eclipse at 2 a.m. or, you know, whatever. And as an adult, I became aware that I couldn't see those things anymore. I live in Chicago. I've been here for 30 years, and the one time I had a house in the Pacific Northwest for about 17 years, and I talk about it on the show occasionally. It was on the Olympic Peninsula of Washington State.
Oh, yes, indeed.
There's very little light there.
Yeah,
and even though I was surrounded by 300-foot tall conifers, I could see more stars there in the one little gap that we had than I can see in Chicago, and I could actually see the Milky Way.
Yeah,
and it's an amazing feeling. And too many of us don't see the stars anymore. We have to describe what the Milky Way is to people because they've never seen it.
and people just don't get it. They don't understand what it looks like. There's a pretty famous story. It goes back to 1994. The Northridge earthquake in L.A. knocked a bunch of power out in the early morning hours. And so the skies above L.A. were dark. People looked up, and they flooded the emergency response centers with calls about the eerie silver cloud that was hanging in the sky. And they were told this is the Milky Way. People are so disconnected from the night sky nowadays that they just have this misconception of what a dark sky looks like.
I read a science fiction tale, because I was also a big science fiction buff, a story about a planet with a double sun. Mm-hmm. And so there was never darkness. And then a confluence happens, an alignment where there was an eclipse, and everything, for the first time in the history of the planet or the history of that race, everything goes dark and the stars pop out. And they weren't on the spiral arm of their galaxy the way we are here in our solar system, but in the center of the galaxy. And suddenly all these stars pop up and everybody sees them, and it chaos ensues and the people go mad, and the planet, is destroyed. That has struck me. The story you just told is something like that, though not on such a grand scale and an absurd scale.
And typically the emotions are quite the opposite when people see a starry sky. Uh-huh. And, people go on vacations to do this. And you talk to anyone. In my job as an astronomer, and I talk to people about the night sky, joining on star parties and things like that. You talk to people, and one of the first things they'll say is, I remember, when I was out in the North Woods of Wisconsin, there were so many stars out there. But that's a common response. People, you start talking to people.
There were so many stars out there. They're always there, folks. That's the point.
Indeed.
They are always there. And part of our problem is that we really haven't paid attention to where we're pointing our lights, our city lights. And I'm one of those guys, when I see these photographs from space of the planet at night and I see all the light, I'm not impressed. I'm terrified. I look at that and I go, holy smoke, what are we doing to ourselves? And this is a serious problem. Audrey, you're the one who brought this to my attention. How is it you got involved in this?
Well, goodness, everyone should take a look at that satellite view of Earth at night. And it's actually called the Black Marble, put out by NASA. And it versus the blue marble, which is everybody else is more familiar with. Mm-hmm. But you'll see how the globe is illuminated at night with streetlights, literally. And that's what's preventing us from seeing the stars. The National Park Service has already warned us that by 2025, 90% of the population in America will never see a starry night sky even once in their lifetime. Now,
what year was that?
By 2025.
Wow.
So, and in the latest predictions, now with municipalities changing over to the bright white LEDs, we're worried that it's going to happen even sooner.
Let's talk about that transition. At one point, we had mercury vapor lights. And then we graduated to sodium vapor lights. And now we're going to LEDs. I don't know if you guys understand the engineering behind this, but what did each of those steps bring about?
Well, to me, what type of light isn't as important as what color spectrum that we use. And what we're finding out is that the big push with the LED lights is efficiency. Unfortunately, they're super efficient in the high blue spectrum, which scatters more, which will definitely increase our sky glow by at least five times, or up to five times, which is quite a bit, 500% over the city of Chicago.
But this is a problem because LEDs are more efficient, and that's where we're going. This is not going to change. So how do we address the issue?
Balance. Just like if we wanted, if we were only focused with efficiency with the automobile, for example, we would have the super lightest weight. We'd make them, we'd make our cars out of styrofoam because they're so lightweight and they'd make it efficient. However, no, we're concerned with safety.
No, but you can't recycle styrofoam. So that's,
well, that's a bad example.
Okay. Well, except the styrofoam manufacturers will tell you, oh, yeah, yeah, you can recycle. It's 100% recyclable, except that nobody in the country does it. So that's the problem.
So we're just saying that, you know, we have to balance our needs. Efficiency is a great thing, but it's only one thing to factor in. The environment is something else to factor in, as well as safety. And when we get David Blask on, he'll be able to explain more of the biological rhythms that are that are disconnected by this light pollution at night.
Well, as if on cue, let us bring in Dr. David Blask. David, are you with us?
I'm with you.
Dr. Blask is professor of structural and cellular biology at the Department of Structural and Cellular Biology, Tulane University School of Medicine, and the Tulane Cancer Center. Perhaps you would like to address what Audrey is talking about here. What kind of physical reaction do we have to this incessant light?
Well, Audrey is exactly right. We do respond to light in very important ways. Of course, we're most we can most relate to light during the day, especially full spectrum sunlight, and that when on a non-cloudy day when we can see the blue sky on a bright sunny day, that's really good for us. And what it does is helps to cue our what we call our biological rhythms, and these biological rhythms run about 24 hours every day in our behavior and our physiology and our metabolism. And those rhythms are called circadian rhythms, meaning about a day. And those rhythms are generated by a particular clock in the brain called the suprachiasmatic nucleus. And that clock needs to be reset every day. It's not a perfect clock. And the sunshine during the day does that, resets the clock. So it's very helpful to have bright, full-spectrum blue skies during the day. However, the situation at night is the total opposite. We evolved to see total darkness during the night. So before the advent of the light bulb, you know, 130 years ago, something like that, we had very bright, full-spectrum days and very dark nights. And this was perfect for assuring that the timing of our biology was appropriate so that we maintained a healthful status. Now, with so much artificial light at night in our 24-hour, 7-day-a-week society, we've literally flipped that evolutionary heritage. So now we see relatively dim light during the day because we're cooped up inside in offices, see very little sunshine. And then at night, we see bright light because most of us work into the night. And this is becoming more and more prevalent. People are on their iPads and their computers and watching TV and are seeing light at a time that they shouldn't be seeing light. And that can have a tremendous impact in disrupting this biological timing mechanism, which is so important for our health. And as a result, we're finding through studies that primarily look at shift workers, people who work night shifts, that several disease states increase in terms of their risk, including cancers, cardiovascular disease, metabolic diseases such as type 2 diabetes and obesity.
That's interesting because my brother-in-law for 20 years was a night cop. and worked night shift. And actually his doctor said, you know what, you've done this long enough. You need to switch to days. This is too long to be in that cycle. Because his sleeping patterns were so irregular. And so, because he was a dad, so he's like coaching baseball and doing those kinds of dad things during the day and then working at night. And they said that it was having an impact on his body.
I can attest to that, because back when I was at Gargantua Radio down the dial, I did a lot of overnights there. And it would be like 3, 4, 5 days in a row where you're defeating your regular cycle or pushing the limit of it. And then you come home at 5 a.m., you get the sleep at 7 or 8, and you wake up at 2 in the afternoon, and you feel like you've been hit with a ball-peen hammer. Now, that's not to say that people can't get in. Well, actually, that's a question for you, Dr. Blask, is does anybody ever get used to that, working overnight?
Well, there may be some people that can adapt. However, the studies that I'm aware of really indicate that that's rare. Even people who work permanent nights versus people who work rotating night shifts, where you would expect their schedule to be such that their clock is always chasing the change in their work shift and their exposure to light or darkness. You expect them to be discombobulated, but you'd think that in permanent night shift workers, that they would adapt, that their day just flips with their night. And your circadian system, your biological timing system, is quite adaptable in that way and could do that. You can do that with animals in the experimental setting where you have very strict control of the light-dark cycle. However, even permanent night shift workers don't adapt for the most part. And so they're just as screwed up as people who are working night shifts to the best of our knowledge. And a lot of that has to do with people when they come home during the day want to spend time with their family, so there's a social thing, and they may not sleep in a very dark room. If you're going to sleep during the day and you're a night shift worker, you have to be in a totally dark room in order for your circadian system to adapt. So the answer is most people don't adapt.
And you'd say it results in health problems. How can you, how is it you can tie those health problems to the lack of light, or light at the wrong time, or darkness? I thought your description was pretty amazing, because I hadn't thought of it this way either. Is that we lock ourselves into dark rooms during the day and then we expose ourselves to bright light at night. That's really flipping things around, and it's really got to screw us up. So what's the correlation? How is it you guys have been able to measure this, Dr. Blask?
Well, there are a group of scientists who are called epidemiologists, and they study basically the incidence of disease in populations, and it can be any disease, of course, and try to connect an increased risk or incidence of disease with certain factors in the environment or genetic factors, so on. And doesn't really matter. And colleagues of mine who work in this area, most notably Richard Stevens and at the University of Connecticut, and Jani Hansen from Denmark, Scott Davis up in Seattle, Washington, the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Center, they've done really elegant work, and others, many others. This has really caught on. Basically, to sort of summarize it all, there's no really good way to measure this phenomenon in human beings. So what they've done is they have looked at night shift workers and to see if, in fact, if you work night shifts, is there an increase in the incidence or risk of a particular disease? And they studied cancer, and mostly breast cancer. And they found that night shift workers have a significantly higher risk of developing breast cancer. And you may ask, well, why? How is this linked to light? Well, night shift work involves obviously exposure to light at night, at various durations and intensities and spectra. So night shift work is considered a surrogate for exposure to light at night. That's the best you can do in a human population, and this seems to hold in the majority of studies. And the data are probably strongest in breast cancer, but it's turning out that prostate cancer in men is not far behind, that men who work night shifts have a significantly increased risk of prostate cancer, developing prostate cancer, and other cancers now, such as colon cancer, pancreatic cancer, lung cancer, even bladder cancer, and some lymphomas are. We're starting to see in some of these studies there's an increased risk. So it's not limited, seems to be not limited to breast cancer. So this is more widespread kind of phenomenon. And then a person like myself takes these data, and then we try to look at this experimentally in the laboratory, in laboratory animals that have these tumors, and we can subject them to light at night to see is tumor growth accelerating, so on and so forth. And the animal studies really bear out what you see in the epidemiological studies.
Wow. That's mind-blowing, as they say. That is Dr. David Blask from Tulane University School of Medicine. Also with me today are Mark Hammergren, who's also a doctor, a PhD, astronomer and director of the Astroscience Workshop at the Adler Planetarium, and Audrey Fisher, director of the Chicago Astronomical Society and the founder and co-chair of One Star at a Time Global Star Park Network. You know, this is the perfect song, actually, for our discussion. This is Elton John, Burn Down the Mission. And it seems to me that is almost where we are with the light problem. Maybe we have to burn down the mission just to keep us all from suffering the ill effects of light pollution. I have to ask you a question, Mark, at the Adler Planetarium, you're right on the edge of the city. How do you see anything from there?
Honestly, it's really tough. Chicago is sadly literally a poster child for light pollution. It was featured, the night sky lights of Chicago were featured on the cover of National Geographic magazine.
And as a article, good thing or a bad thing?
As a bad thing. An article about light pollution a few years ago. Mm-hmm. So we have this terrible, nasty distinction as being one of the worst places for light pollution. And we are hampered by that at the Adler. We have an observatory out back that the Doane Observatory, 20-inch professional-grade telescope that is capable of cutting-edge research. But we can't do effective research on that because of the lights in Chicago. I've tried, and I was scooped by another team using a small amateur telescope in some city's suburbs.
Because of the lights.
Because of the lights in Chicago, yeah.
Yeah. So, Audrey, you want to address this. You are crafting a letter to go to the Emanuel administration to say, we got to fix this problem. How do we fix it?
You know, we've got such a special opportunity. We can turn down the light pollution by turning up activism and people just getting involved. You know, it's just like the climate reality group. It's just individuals really can make a difference. We can basically on an individual level, we can look at what we do in our own yards. Mm-hmm. You know, we can take a look at our lighting. So any of the yard lighting that we use, does it happen to shine into our neighbors, you know, windows? Do we think
Well, of course it does. All right, let me stop you right there. Okay, we're all so darn scared of our neighbors and of everybody, every other human being on the planet, that we deliberately shine those lights because we're scared of gangs, we're scared of burglars, we're scared of everything. We're a frightened species, and that's one of the reasons we have lit up this planet, is because we don't trust our fellow human beings, and we want to monitor them every second of the day. I don't see how we reverse that.
Well, we have a lot of choices. For example, we can use lights that have that are motion activated. They have timers or they have dimmers. We want to make sure that if we do use light in our property, which we have every right to do, that it stays within our property lines, that it doesn't cross into our neighbor's property, just like we wouldn't turn up the stereo just because there's a certain tune on that we absolutely love and we think our neighbors should hear it too at the same time.
Well, if you do that in a van, you might end up being shot, okay? So, and that's, again, it just proves what I'm talking about. But you pointed out something to me that I put up on my website, MikeNovak.net. If you go to this week's show, there's an Illinois Coalition for Responsible Outdoor Lighting. I had no idea. Okay, I had no idea that anything like this existed. And they show the difference between what they call good and bad light fixtures, and it's stunning. It's absolutely stunning. The photos are there. You can go click on them and just see the difference.
Right. It's just educating yourself a little bit about the decision making. You know, it's when you buy a light, it's not like buying a light for your Barbie house. You know, there really is technical designs that basically the bottom line is all the light should point downward, nothing sideways, nothing up into the sky. People that love their trees so much, it's so much that they want to shine a light upward into this to the tree.
That's just not a good idea. But
not a good idea for the birds or
that's,
the tree.
Okay, I got to stop you right there again. Mm-hmm. That's the industry that I represent to some degree on this radio show, which is the horticultural industry. And their idea is shine the stuff up into the trees so we get a dramatic effect. And you would say, put the light at the top of the tree and shine it down, maybe, or something else.
For a flagpole, I would say put the light at the top of the flagpole and shine down. But as far as a tree, you know, Dr. David Blask will tell you that every single living creature has a circadian. And they also need this melatonin. And even a single-celled organism has retained the necessity to reset its biological clock. That is how intrinsically important it is. So for the tree itself, it's much happier if it has a night and a day. And same thing with the birds that are nesting.
The biodiversity in the tree, the insect. In fact, let's bring in again Dr. Blask. Is Audrey making sense here?
Yes, she's making a lot of sense. Yeah, all species have a biological timing system that's been conserved throughout evolution. And Audrey's right. You can go back 3.8 billion years in the evolution of the Earth, and you see single-celled organisms such as cyanobacteria that have circadian rhythms. In fact, they have a nighttime melatonin rhythm. And the molecule melatonin, I didn't really clarify this earlier, but melatonin is one of the signals from the brain that tells all the cells, tissues, and organs of the body what time of the day or night it is. That's how the master brain clock communicates this information about light dark cycles and timing to the cells in the body. And all organisms from single-celled organisms to complex organisms such as ourselves have this timing mechanism and have melatonin. Even plants have their own intrinsic timing system, and we're finding that at least the plants that have been studied, especially edible plants, make their own melatonin. They have melatonin.
Wow.
So the photosynthetic capabilities of plants are obviously linked to daytime sunshine, but there are intrinsic mechanisms that partially involve melatonin. We're just learning about this now that are important for the survival and thriving of plant species.
Does it mean, doctor, that we're messing with the plant melatonin when we shine lights on them at night?
I don't know that for sure. There's no evidence for that yet. But I wouldn't be surprised. I wouldn't be surprised if light pollution is not only detrimental to other animal species, as Audrey mentioned, in terms of their migratory patterns and reproductive patterns, but also to plant species as well. So we just take it for granted that, well, you know, you're going to shine some light up in the air or on plants, it'll look nice, and not really understanding the biology of these organisms, and not realizing that we could be doing something quite detrimental.
You know, it's interesting. I didn't know how I was going to weave this into the conversation today. Sometimes I pick up stuff and I bring it to the station, and now I've just found the perfect place, because geneticists have assembled the genome of a living creature with more than 23 billion base pairs, seven times the size of a human's, the largest one ever sequenced. Anybody want to guess what the plant is? It is a plant. It's a loblolly pine. Okay. Yeah. And you kind of go, huh?
Yeah.
But it just tells you that there are things that we don't know yet. We're still figuring these kinds of things out. We just have a few more minutes here. How do we get the ball rolling, Audrey?
Well, for the one thing, we're at a super special crossroads right now, and we're about ready to relight the city of Chicago, which, by the way, is scientifically measured the most light-polluted city in the world.
Woohoo! We're number one! Wait. There we go.
Oh, gosh.
Yet another victory.
So what we really...
Go Team Chicago!
What we really need is to insist that the lights that we use are all shine downward. Mm-hmm. We can ask for lights that are timed with dimmers. So we don't need them as bright at 3 o'clock in the morning as we do at 11 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
They also have, keep them out of the blue spectrum. There are...
And you say we're going to make a trip. And by the way, Dave and Bob, I'm going to get to you in just a second here. I almost forgot about our phone calls, but I do want to bring them in. We're going to make that transition to LEDs, and the idea is we need to lobby. We need to go to the city and say, you got to do this smart. You can't just do it the way we've done it in the past, right?
And we can't just preach to the choir about this kind of stuff. It's easy to get fixed on the aesthetics of it, but there are incredible practical reasons for reducing light pollution, as we heard from Dr. Blask. The light pollution is unnecessary. It's unhealthy. It's actually unsafe for us, and it's wasteful. There is no reason.
Yeah, the
for
energy waste is staggering. Let's go to the phones very quick. Dave in Piatone, you're on the Mike Novak Show. Good morning.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
Good. I'm glad you called in. What do you want to contribute?
Well, I'd like to share a success story, which I posted on your Facebook page, where I actually got some streetlights changed by my house. Because I have an upstairs to my house where both my kids sleep on the second floor, and the streetlights were literally shining into their bedrooms on the second floor. And these aren't lights that are like right next to the house; they're about 150 feet away, and they would cast shadows into their rooms. That's how bright they were. And so, through trying to get a hold of ComEd through the their online stuff, I kept running into roadblocks. They'd come out at the wrong time. I'd ask them to come out at specific times. They wouldn't. What I eventually did was I went to my village and said, hey, what can we do about this? They got me in touch with their liaison at ComEd, who contacted me within a couple days. He came out, took a look at the lights. He left a hanger on my door, telling me what he had done. And within 3 days, I had two new street lights that light up the intersections near my house, and you can see on the picture the dramatic difference where the old one literally was shining all over the place and the new one just shines down at the intersection, lights up what it needs to down below it, but it doesn't light up my daughter's bedrooms.
I'm looking at it right now. By the way, this is David Fuller. He's with eyesonthesky.com, and obviously this is a battle you've been fighting for a while.
Yes, it is. I make short YouTube videos that help people to find things in the night sky, even from places as light polluted as the Adler Planetarium. I do sometimes go up there and help people find things in the sky. But so at most anywhere that they can, you know, that you can see even just a few stars or even the brighter planets, I try and show them that and also talk a little bit about how to help reduce light pollution.
Hey, Lisa, let's see if we can share David's post. He on the main page of did you already do that? Oh, she's way ahead of me. She's always got this going. David, thank you so much for contributing. Again, his website is www.eyesonthesky.com. And what would your advice be to approaching the city about this?
I would say that what they need to do is just remember that, particularly if we're going to LED lights, LEDs are directional. They've got a little lens in them that points the light in a specific direction. So you have to design a light badly to make the light go sideways and up. So if we just keep the lights directed in where the direction they need to go, which is down, then we can help reduce the problem pretty substantially and without a lot of effort.
All right, David, thank you so much for calling, and good luck on your efforts, and thanks for your contribution. Have a great Sunday.
Thanks, Mike. You too.
Let's go to Bob, who's, I understand, Bob, you're in Arizona?
Yes, I'm calling from Sierra Vista, Arizona.
And I see here you're the past president of the Astronomical League.
The Astronomical League, and also past president of the International Dark Sky Association.
Aha.
If I could, I'd like to just address one of your concerns, which was the crime and security issue.
Yes.
That is one of the most difficult issues in this to address.
Of course.
And, you know, I can relate to this because I was afraid of the dark when I was a boy, and my mother used to leave the bedroom light on for me, and then when I'd fall asleep, she'd turn it off. And lots of us are afraid of the dark. But I often ask the question, are criminals afraid of the dark? Do criminals need light to see to commit crime? And when you put a bright light around, say, an ATM machine at night, and you walk up to it and you're blinded by the glare, who benefits from that light? You or the criminal who's hiding in the bushes to the side? You know, there's a lot more to lighting than just turning on a light. We all feel safe, but are we really? So that's one of the most difficult challenges.
That's
the other thing I'd like to address is just the overall change to our environment. For millions and millions of years, all life on Earth evolved with a day and a night. Who are we to change the night into day without understanding exactly what we're doing to migrating birds, to sea turtles, to the plants, to the insects? Some species of insects vanish because of all the bright lights. So what are we doing? Do we understand that? And then, of course, there's the human health impacts and so many other things. And the bottom line is, this isn't like nuclear waste. This isn't like all the other really serious environmental challenges we face. This one has an easy solution. It's shine lights down, keep them dim, turn them off when you don't need them, use the right amount of light in the right spectrum, and we'll all live safer, healthier, protecting wildlife, and preserving the magnificent beauty of the night sky that we're all losing touch with.
Bob, that's eloquently put, and I appreciate your contribution. We're flat out of time, but thank you so much for calling in. I appreciate that. You have a good...
Pleased to be able to participate, and I wish you all luck in having good lighting codes like we have in Cochise County, Arizona, that protect the night.
Well, we're going to work on it here, but, you know, we're a little backwards in Chicago. We're trying to work on it. All right, have a great one. Take care.
Thank
Bye-bye.
You very much.
And I would guess this is a big educational hurdle with aldermen.
Oh,
it is.
Everything's a big educational hurdle with aldermen, okay?
I mean, I've met a few who don't
everything.
Speak.
And one thing that Chicagoans may not realize, but there's a mandate on the books that demands that streetlights shine to the keyhole of the front door, the typical residential Chicago street. And that same light that shines to the keyhole of the front door also shines into people's bedroom windows.
Of course it does. Yeah.
Which is, we have to get our people to call our aldermen and demand that to stop.
And I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that next Saturday at 8:30 p.m. is Earth Hour, where people turn off their lights for an hour. And this is the perfect timing for this. For those people who are concerned with this issue, this would be a great way to get on board. And I've got the link to Earth Hour on my website, and the link to the various groups here that, Chicago Astronomical Society and the Illinois Coalition for Responsible Outdoor Lighting. So go to my website and read about it. And Audrey, thank you for being here. And Mark, I appreciate Dr. Blask. Thank you so much for being on the phone. I appreciate that, too.
Thank you, Mike. Appreciate it.
Have a great Sunday.
You too.
You too. Yes, Audrey?
People are welcome to come down to the Adler for two things. The second Friday of April, we're going to have a talk at 7 p.m. about light pollution issues. It's free. It's no charge. Just come on down and have some fun. Go to the south entrance. And also, we've got the total lunar eclipse on April 15th at midnight
cool.
to 4 a.m. on the 15th.
You won't see it in Chicago, but
see the lunar eclipse.
I know. I'm kidding. I was making a bad joke. All right. Well, I hope people take advantage of it.